Hey, welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're online all the time at npr.org. And, you know, if you were listening, as you should have been, we just did a segment on the great Tam Tam shortage of 2008. And our lovely guests brought in all sorts of delicious treats. And now all of our producers who've gathered in the studio for the most have their mouths full.
I had to push the chew button.
But never fear, it shall not stop us from talking about what you've been emailing lately. We're going to do it in the most. Okay, who doesn't have their mouth full? Mark?
Score.
Okay, what do you got?
Most viewed on Yahoo and a number of other sites. I mean, if you're in Madison, Wisconsin, you deliver the mail, you've already got it pretty rough. I mean, bad weather, frozen tundra. But lately, a lot of male wild turkeys have been poking and spurring the letter carriers there. And actually, it's not an attack. It's a pickup line. It's mating season in turkey world, and they're feeling kind of amorous. And apparently, mail carriers and their trucks are especially hot to turkeys because of the red, white, and blue coloring. So, you know, the defense they have right now that they've been using is trying water pistols, but apparently the turkeys have gotten used to that. It's not working out so well anymore. So the new trick is long sticks, not really a high tech solution, but they're doing something.
Turkeys, lowbrow.
Yeah, you know, but a little less humane, though, I gotta say. Apparently, speaking of less humane, turkeys have kind of a difficult history in Madison. One broke through a window and was tasered by police, but it was fine and is, you know, could have made it to a Thanksgiving table next year.
Did the police not have a stick? Did the turkey win?
No.
Escaped death once, only to be someone's turkey next
year. Did you guys
year.
Know that Ben Franklin wanted to make the turkey the official bird of America?
I think I'd
is that
that
true, Dan Pashman?
It is true, yes.
It's not regal enough. Sorry to all you turkeys out there. Speaking of turkeys, Trish McKinney.
Hello. I'm not sure I like that segue, but all right, I'll take
it. You could have been the bird of America.
Yeah. That's true. That's so true.
Yeah, Jacob has a stick, though, so I don't need to worry.
I am flightless, I will say. Actually, though, turkeys do fly. All right, so they don't fly very far. All right.
Moving
I have
on.
The most emailed story at USA Today. It's called British Grocery Chain Hits America with Fresh Ideas. It's a grocery chain called Fresh and Easy. It's owned by the British conglomerate Tesco. And apparently they're like one of they're the third largest retailer or grocer, I'm not quite sure, in the world. And they're going up against Walmart. But so their U.S. invasion is not really going as well as they had originally planned. They have opened 59 Fresh and Easy stores in Southern California, Las Vegas, and Phoenix. But people don't really understand how to shop there. Or it's so not
your
like...
Your strange grocery stores confuse us.
It is kind of, because apparently they're really small stores. They have very few brands. Most of them are actually store brands. And the aisles are wide enough for three shopping carts to go through. You can see everything. The shelves are really low, so you can see from one end of the store to the other. And they do things like... They have this thing they call the kitchen table, where if you see something you're not sure you want it, you take it to this kitchen table and a staffer will open it up and give you some.
Like
they'll pick up some.
That sounds like a great idea.
It's supposed to be all foods that have no artificial ingredients or preservatives in their own brand. They do sell other name brands as well.
Here's the thing. It's called Fresh and Easy. It's rocket science, people. It's a reason Americans have different associations with Fresh and Easy.
I know. I didn't go there.
I went right there. First thing.
Always in the gutter.
Because
well,
I'll say you're
Stewart.
Fresh, but I won't say you're the other part of that name. And anyway, and it's also all self-checkout. There are no cashiers.
Oh, that could be it. That could be.
I think people are just like, what is this? I don't know. So anyway, they're not doing as well as they'd hoped, but they'll probably...
There's self-checkouts. You get in the fight with the computer. You're like, I've put it in the bagging area. Oh, we lost Trisha Mike.
She's still talking.
Okay.
Sorry, Trisha. Ian.
Yeah.
Sorry, Trish, we lost your mic.
This is a most emailed from Newsday, Long Island paper. So, you know, it's the last year for Shea Stadium, the Mets stadium. Mm-hmm. And so the Mets had this contest. Hey, you know, we have a sing-along in the eighth inning. Why don't you guys pick a song? And they nominated, you know, I'm a Believer, the Monkees song, I'll Be There for You, the Friends theme.
From the Rembrandts.
Yeah, Living on a Prayer, Sweet Caroline, you know, all these songs. And they let Mets fans vote on them. And so the Mets fans were like, sure, Mets, we would love any of these songs. We would love, you know, Sweet Caroline. Here, let's listen to Sweet Caroline, Mets.
Never gonna give you up.
Oh, yeah.
Never gonna let you down.
Yeah. The Mets have been Rickrolled.
The Mets were Rickrolled.
Thanks to two internet campaigns, There's a huge. We won't know until the opening day game tonight. But the Mets there was a write-in campaign to make "Never Gonna Give You Up" the official eighth inning sing-along song of the Mets. And I looked, and there's like all these email threads and comment threads about it. And there's two sides to this. It's basically Mets fans like, look, as Mets fans, we have to make this our theme song. And then everybody else is like, look, we hate the Mets. We have to make this their theme song.
Little reverse psychology.
I really hope it happens.
Sabotage. Telling me it's going to happen. Hey, Dan, I'm going to let you go.
All right, guys. I got a most email here from Yahoo News. Starbucks launching everyday coffee in U.S. This is, Starbucks hasn't been doing so well business-wise lately. They had some big corporate meetings, and they brought the CEO back, and this is one of their first big pushes to try to get sales up. Apparently, I didn't even know this, Starbucks previously served a different coffee each week.
Yeah.
And so they thought that was confusing to some customers, so they're going to stick with one brew called Pike Place Roast, and it starts today, Pike Place Roast, and it's their new everyday coffee, and they're giving out free samples all over the place, including right outside in Bryant Park.
There's a giant faux Starbucks set up just across the street.
Good, because we don't have any real Starbucks.
I know.
Yeah, there's none around
here.
Yeah,
they're so hard to find. I actually have thought up a slogan, though. I'm going to go downstairs to the CEO's office in the park there and pitch it for the new everyday coffee. Starbucks Everyday Coffee. It's the opiate of the masses.
Does that work? I don't know if he's going to like that.
I just came up with that phrase out of nowhere. I don't know.
Yeah, it was good.
And you got one more.
I got one more. We always like to do the most emailed off the NPR.org. And this one is a story that's important to the BPV staffers. It commemorates a day 75 days ago yesterday, the anniversary of the beginning of the end of Prohibition.
75 years.
So, what did I say?
Days.
Thank you.
Okay.
75 years ago yesterday. It was the beginning of the end of Prohibition.
The most confusing anniversary piece of all time.
I'm just going to let Robert Siegel say it. Basically, beer with less than 3.2% alcohol became legal.
There you go.
It was 9 months later that the rest of Prohibition ended. Robert Siegel has more.
April the 7th is here, and it is a real occasion for thankfulness, marking a newfound freedom for the American people.
A newfound freedom. Now, you may recall that several years later, FDR enumerated four freedoms: freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Well, this freedom didn't quite make the final four, but it made a lot of people smile that day.
There is a song in our hearts. Happy days are here again. And they are here again. For out of a maze of confusion and anxiety has come a beacon light to guide the way to better times.
The speaker was August Busch Jr. of St. Louis. His family founded and owned Anheuser-Busch. On April 7, 75 years ago, Americans regained the freedom to down a cold one, legally, for the first time in years. Busch was talking on a CBS radio broadcast as the first cases of beer rolled off the assembly line. In 1917, the 18th Amendment established prohibition, banning intoxicating liquor, which it left undefined. Franklin Roosevelt vowed to end prohibition, but first he did something easier. He got Congress to declare that beer with 3.2% alcoholic content was not an intoxicating liquor. It would take until December 1933 for the 21st Amendment to repeal the 18th, but for 8 months, 3.2 beer was the only adult beverage allowed.
Once again, freight cars are pulling in, loaded with grain from American farms.
Historian William Rohrabaugh is the author of Alcoholic Republic. He says it was natural for August Busch to conflate the flow of legal beer with getting people back to work during the Depression. That had been a big argument against Prohibition.
It was one of the arguments. I'm not sure it's the biggest argument, but it was one of the arguments. I mean, I think actually the more important one for most Congress, members of Congress, and particularly for state legislators, was the tax revenue. They looked at that because, you know, property taxes were shrinking because property values were shrinking and income taxes were shrinking. And so you had a declining economy. Well, here was a source of revenue, and all you had to do was legalize alcohol and you could tax it.
May I add just a word about good, wholesome beer, which contributes so much to good cheer, good health, and true temperance.
I think in many ways, Augie Busch was actually a kind of visionary. There were some people in the brewing business who, you know, wanted to sell beer without paying taxes. But he understood the complexities of the situation and understood that he could, in effect, make a kind of bargain. You know, you let us sell beer and we'll pay taxes. And, of course, there was an illegal alcohol industry during Prohibition, which was untaxed and where the profits went to people like Al Capone. and so all of that would come to an end.
So far as we know, did it happen that way?
It certainly shrank the role of organized crime. I mean, organized crime went into other things.
And it did help stimulate the economy. To hear Anheuser-Busch tell it, the economy was on the move.
It certainly benefited communities that had big breweries like St. Louis or Milwaukee.
For people today who may be accustomed to hearing politicians described as, well, the closest thing, I guess, would be politicians who are described as pro-choice or pro-life, some social issue that divides elected officials and one is in one camp or the other. The notion that until 75 years ago, at least, people were either wet or dry, that had been a big factor in American politics, who was wet and who was dry.
It really starts as early as the 1830s, and by the 1850s, it was a major political issue in many parts of the country and basically remained so, you know, down until 1930 or so. In fact, one of the major concerns that the brewers have, or sellers, in 1933 is that Prohibition might come back. They're very much afraid of that.
Really? They were concerned that the dry forces could reclaim the day after that.
There were many times in the past, going back to the 1850s, when dryness would swell up and take over for a while, and then wetness would come back, and it would oscillate back and forth between the two with no stability at all. One of the major reasons that Prohibition finally did come to an end was that we compromised, and we compromised by having much greater government regulation of alcohol. Before Prohibition, there was almost no government regulation of alcohol. There was no minimum drinking age, for example, and so in 1933, the brewers and the distillers and the vintners were quite willing to accept much tighter government control in return for the hope that this would prevent any further attempts at prohibition.
Well, William Rarba, it's great to talk with you again.
My pleasure.
That was NPR's Robert Siegel reporting. You can find links to that story and all the stories that you heard on The Most Today on our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.